started. It's a pleasure to welcome you to the second Physics Department Colloquium of the year. I'm William Trischoff, a member of the Experimental Particle Physics Group here, and it's my pleasure to introduce Carl Haber, a colleague of mine. Carl and I have collaborated on and off over the last 10 or 15 years in high energy physics experiments, ranging from once in Chicago to Geneva. And one of the things I always tell my students is, of course, to make advances in experimental physics and physics in general, I guess, one needs to make orders of magnitude improvement in your ability to detect and measure things. And that's the kind of thing that Carl's been doing for the last 15 or 20 years, improving tracking detectors in particle physics experiments down from 100 micron positions of tracks, positions and directions of tracks, to 10 and even better than 10 micron positions and directions of tracks. Somewhere over the last 2 or 3 years, in fact, this hasn't become enough of a challenge for Carl, and so he's picked up a hobby, but I hope, as you'll see, he's applied many of the things he's learned in particle physics to his new hobby, and so he's going to tell us today about something completely different, and that's the recording of sound, and explain a little bit how it's related to particle physics.
Thank you, William, and and thank you for having me here at Toronto today. Can everybody hear me all the way in the back? Yeah, good. So as William said, we're both in particle physics, and I'm going to show you a little cartoon sort of version of particle physics to kind of tell you how I got into the subject that I'm going to talk about in the talk. So here's Fermilab, and that's obviously an accelerator complex. And the experiment that William and I initially worked on together is CDF. And here's the CDF detector. There's a person, and it sits here, and beams collide in the center of this device when it's put together. And if we go a little bit closer, there are things that sort of on the meter scale, which is arrays of precision tracking sensors. We call them silicon strip detectors. And if we kind of zoom in some more, this is now the sort of few centimeter scale. You actually can see some of these tracking elements, and this is a sort of computer display of the data generated by the various detector systems that indicate the trajectories of the tracks that are emerging. So to work in this environment and to make sense of the data, there's obviously the toolkit that we use in experimental particle physics of large-scale data collection and analysis processes, computer pattern recognition to pull signals and suppress noise in data like this. And then to put all these detectors together, we use very precise mechanical survey methods. And so this was very familiar to me, and it's the stuff I was sort of doing day in and day out. And a few years ago, I heard a report on the radio just by chance, driving between a factory where some of this stuff was being made and the lab. And it was about the state of historical sound collections. And in this case, they talked about the Library of Congress, which is the major government library and sound collection and obviously books and so forth in Washington. And they were saying that if you go back into the history of recorded sound, there are examples of things that were somehow at risk over time. And somehow they needed people to come up with some way of stabilizing these collections so that they would be available in the future. And it just occurred to me that some of the methods that we were using to actually build these detectors and deal with the data, if you thought about applying them in a slightly different way, you might be able to somehow come to the aid of this need. And that's what I'm going to tell you about. It really just came right out of the fact that we were doing these things and thinking about the measurement techniques and the methods, and it just said, seems like it was just a different way of looking at another system. So that's really my talk. So it's had various names over time, but imaging the voices seemed like a good one because I'm going to use optical methods to deal with sound. And these are some examples of old sound recording formats. Some of you younger folks may not even recognize some of these things. This is not a this is not a black CD. It's actually something called a phonograph record. And these are actually even an older medium, which Edison pioneered, which is the cylinder. And I can't help but notice that even just the similarity of the shapes that we find, although the scales are quite different. Anyway, I have my primary collaborator is a postdoc at Berkeley who works now in astronomical data analysis, Vitaly Fadeev. But we were doing a lot of work on the ATLAS project together when we initiated this work. Various people now at the Library of Congress and other people from the sort of sound and library community. And this work's been supported now by a number of agencies in the U.S. government and some foundations and companies that have found what we're doing interesting and given us equipment or help in various ways. So as I started to say, I'd heard this report, and I've learned through reading and talking to people in that community that, of course, there are these extensive sound collections of historical value, and they suffer from sort of the ravages of time. They're damaged. Some of them are delicate or even broken, and they're also further decaying with time through various effects, and I'll give you a little more detail later. And they're also made of diverse materials. Like, everybody knows, vinyl records, but there's probably 24 different materials that sound was mechanically recorded on over time. So one thing is, of course, to stop this process and preserve these artifacts. The other thing is that these large collections, also in other media like books and so forth, want to move everything into the digital realm so that not only is it somehow preserved, but people can get access to it readily, obviously over the internet or in a library. They can just, you know, click on something and get access to it. And access is a big sort of theme also for libraries and archives. And so these are the issues that they or we face. Again, just another way of putting it, they use the term preservation and the term access, and it's very meaningful for them, those two words. Okay, and preservation means that if you have an artifact, in this case it's going to be a sound recording, they want to preserve it. If it's particularly valuable, they want to do this with the highest quality they can. So it's kind of like a prioritized process. They're going to do it in order of perceived importance, but they're willing to throw whatever resources are necessary to do the job. The word access to them means that they want to put entire collections, irrespective of whether you think one thing is more important than another. They want the public to decide later on. They want to put entire collections into digital form. And to do that, it's not this special preservation approach, but it's more like a mass approach. And if it's the case of digitization, they want to find ways of using automated tools to migrate collections into that realm. And this implies that the quality of the transfer may not be as high because you're trying to do a lot of it than the very specialized case when you're trying to preserve. So the approach, just very schematically, and I'll go into more detail in the talk, is to take these objects, which are, you know, physical objects, they're mechanical structures with shapes and textures and so forth, and without touching them, so using optical methods, measure the actual physical shape of this object in detail and move it into the digital realm. And once you have it there, what you can do is you can emulate essentially what the needle would do if it was playing it, if you have sufficient resolution, obviously, in the map. And then you can extract the sound and process it and so forth without touching it. So it's a sort of, you know, it's the notion of somehow a virtual player. But these pictures, I mean, I'll explain to you what they actually mean. They're really just meant to be suggestive of kind of the kind of information that you might find on the surface. So here's a quick little description of the history of recorded sound, just to kind of set the dates and the milestones, if you like. I mean, everybody knows Thomas Edison invented the phonograph, and we credit him with being the first guy to record sound. But actually, about almost 20 years before, a man named Leon Scott invented a machine he called the phonoautograph. And what it did is, this is a picture of one, it scratched this pattern of sound from a diaphragm onto a strip of paper that was coated with lampblack. So he could record sound, but he had no way to play it back. So Edison really invented reproduction of sound, because what he did is something very similar, but he embossed it, the sound, onto tinfoil. And then that tinfoil pattern could drive a needle in reverse and could excite a diaphragm, and then obviously we could hear the sound. A couple years later, Alexander Graham Bell came along, and he introduced wax as a medium into which the sound would be embossed rather than foil, and that was more robust and could be reproduced, copied, and so forth more readily. A couple years later, Emil Berliner invented introduced the use of a disc rather than a cylinder as a place to store the sound information, and he called that the gramophone. And in his invention, the sound was stored in a groove that went from side to side rather than in a sort of vertically embossed structure. After this, there was a big fight between the people who thought cylinders were better and vertical modulation was better, and the people who thought disks were better. And it's kind of like PCs and Macs and Beta and VHS, you know, one of these technology battles that went on and on and on. But at the heart of the battle, Edison didn't like the idea that as a groove on a disk spiraled in, for constant angular rotation at a fixed frequency, you'd have to tighten essentially the wiggle as you went closer and closer. And he just thought that was a very ugly feature and would somehow degrade the quality as a function of position, whereas on a cylinder, you were always at the same radius. And, well, in the end, it turned out that you could store more disks on the shelf than you could cylinders. They were bulky, and also you could press them much more easily in the disk case. And these kind of practical concerns, you know, it sounds a little funny, but these practical concerns really pushed, obviously, cylinders out because nobody sees them anymore. Everything that was done before 1925 was done acoustically, meaning there were no amplifiers involved. There were horns, diaphragms, mechanical linkages. But in 1925, Western Electric introduced electrical components into the process. So now you could amplify and you could filter. And this then was the end of the acoustic era, if you like, and recordings were made and reproduced electrically after that. Around the time of Edison's death in 1920, which was, I think he died in 1930, but in 1929, cylinders basically stopped being produced. But a variation on the gramophone disc was introduced called the lacquer transcription disc. So it was a plate of metal or glass on which lacquer was coated, a thin film. And you could use it to make a recording by scratching the pattern, essentially in real time, into the disc. And these could be carried out into the field, and they were used to do interviews and document people singing on farms or radio shows being recorded and all sorts of things. So they're historically very important because they're all unique. During the war, a lot of work was done in Germany on magnetic recording, but tape really came into use in a production sense after the war in 1947. Typically, a disc would hold, let's say, a few minutes of sound, but in 1948, a long-playing disc, and that's getting to be the familiar format, was introduced. 10 years later, a stereo was added to that format. In 1963, the cassette tape, which I'm sure everybody here has seen, was added. I think that was a big step backwards, but and if you've ever tried to fix one of those things. Now, obviously, in this period, sound is recorded, and the position on the disc is the analog of time. So these were analog recordings. But in 1982, people started to sample the sound wave, and we entered the digital realm, obviously, that I think you're all quite familiar with, and that was with the advent of the commercial advent of the CD. And then finally, sort of a couple years ago, the iPod came out. So that's a kind of quick trip through sound. Many other things along the way, but I felt like these were the ones that were, you know, worth extracting. So let's now go back to those images and learn something about the physical scales of the surface, because if we're going to measure these things, we need to know with what precision the measurements are going to be done. So this is a little piece taken out of the surface of one of those Edison cylinders. It's about a millimeter or so on the side. And what you see are something that looks like ridges and sort of valleys. And the way the sound was stored is that the valley floor would be modulated, and that would push a stylus up and down. This is called a vertical recording because the sound information is stored in a vertical movement of the surface. Don't worry again how this picture was made, because I'm going to explain that to you. Now, if you slice right through here, this is a cut through this image, and what you see are the valleys and the ridges, and this little band here is supposed to indicate the fact that the valley floor is moving. The whole depth of this thing is only about 10 or 15 microns, which is really not very much at all, considering these things were being manufactured quite regularly almost sort of 100 years ago. And so all the modulation that occurs is within that 10 micron or so envelope. On the other hand, if you look at the disc and we make a cut across it, the grooves are of constant depth because it's a lateral recording, and the groove actually moves from side to side. And here the sort of distance between grooves is, you know, half a millimeter or so, and it's within an envelope of, let's say, a fraction of a micron to 100 microns or so that the sound is stored. And the other thing to say about both of these pictures, and a good thing to keep in mind, is that the sound is stored redundantly in this entire profile, because the whole thing moves around. Whereas if we put a needle here, the needle, like you can see this needle, it's really only going to make sort of 2 points of contact. But the sound is everywhere because the whole groove moves in response to the information which is stored there. So here's just a kind of example of the sound you might get off an old recording. And I want to indicate some of the sort of the defects that have been incurred over time. So this is time across, you know, the recording, and not historical time, obviously. And this is some envelope that indicates the waveform, how it's evolving. And there are a couple of features. One feature here is that there's sort of a band, and that is a representation of a kind of continuous broadband noise that you'll hear, and people call that hiss, which is very, I think, familiar to anybody who's listened to anything. It's kind of a shh sound. And there are also sharp features, and those are typically due to defects, scratches, dirt, and so forth in the recording, and so that's what these little sharp occurrences are. And then you can see there's a very regular array of them. That's because there's a scratch that crosses many revolutions of the item. This happens to be from a disc. So I'm going to play this. There'll be a gap because there are two separate sections of the same recording, but it kind of gives you an idea of what we face if we think about the condition of these older recordings. That's the gap. Okay, so obviously we would like these recordings to not get any worse than this when we try to play them, right? But also, I mean, if possible, if there's some way to overcome some of these effects, that would be, you know, quite attractive as well. So now I told you that the media upon which sound is stored is diverse, and there were many different materials. So this slide is supposed to indicate to you what some of these different materials are. And it's nice to actually play a few samples of things that, you know, typically might have been found on each of these media, and also kind of motivate by the value of what are on these, you know, that this is sort of a worthwhile thing for any of us to be worrying about. So this again is the phonograph disc. It's typically before 1950, they rotate at 78 revolutions per minute, and they're made of shellac and they're pressed. And they can last a long time if you take care of them, but they suffer from handling problems. They wear down, they get scratched. More and more you play them, they break, and so forth. So by far, these are the largest element of the sound collections. I mean, there are hundreds of thousands of them. They contain all sorts of things, international music from all over the world, early jazz, blues, folk, dance music, et cetera, et cetera. So this is a 1920 recording, which actually comes from Canada. And it's just typical of something that you might find on one of these. Okay, so now this little triplet of images, these are forms of the transcription disc that I talked about. So because you coat lacquer on a substrate, typically the coefficients of thermal expansion of the coating and the base are different. So over time and with temperature cycling, essentially the stuff starts to lift off and crack and chip off like paint or other coatings do on dissimilar materials. And that's what you see over here. Another problem is that the lacquer breaks down chemically, and a process that the preservationists call exudation occurs, and a white kind of pasty material deposits itself or condenses itself on, precipitates itself on the surface and kind of blocks up the groove and becomes very problematic for playback. And then this over here is another version of the disc that I didn't mention before, is an aluminum transcription disc. They actually emboss the sound directly into aluminum when they're recording it. And those suffer from corrosion and oxidation and also just poor mechanical structure when they're formed. There was a man in the U.S. called John Lomax, and he worked for the Library of Congress and traveled around the American Southeast recording people in the 1930s or approximate, with also his son Alan was a participant for many years in this as well. And they recorded people on farms, plantations, prisons, work camps, and documented the music that was, you know, being sung by people at the time. So this is a recording that they made in 1935, actually in a prison in Virginia. Okay, so here obviously are the cylinders, and they're typically made of either wax or an early plastic. And obviously they break and crack, they get worn with time. They also suffer from a biological problem, which is a mold that eats the wax and actually is destructive. And that's what this kind of brown pattern that you see on it is. And there's a continuum of this. I mean, in some cases it's, you know, it's been a feast, and in other cases it's quite light. But it's completely destructive when it occurs and where it occurs. Now, this is off a cylinder from 1884, so it's very, very old. And it's the British poet Alfred Lord Tennyson, and he's going to recite a part of his poem, The Charge of the Light Brigade. Before I play it, I just want to remark. I'm just giving you examples of sound and its value. These are not things that we ourselves have worked on. Sometimes I forget to mention that, and people ask me, oh, are these things that you're actually doing? And this is just a kind of illustrative slide. So here's Tennyson and the Charge of the Light Brigade. Anybody follow that? Into the, yeah. Theirs is not to reason why, theirs is not to do and die. If you've ever worked for somebody, you've probably thought that to yourself, so, okay. Anyway, the next one, I'll be a little easier on you. This is Edison, and you can definitely hear what he's saying, and he's describing a trip he took around the world. Okay, could you get that? He's just basically listing cities that he visited. All right, now the next media is something which is a little more obscure, and many of you, I'm sure, won't be familiar with it. It's called the plastic dictation belt. And so it's a plastic loop that would be put into a machine, and typically in the, say, the 1950s and 60s, it would have been used in an office to, say, dictate a letter. And then a typist would play this thing back, and it wasn't meant to be played many times. It was just to move the dictation into typewritten form. It was also used to take insurance testimony and do investigations or whatever. However, the U.S. government used these things extensively also to document things that were going on. So, for example, Lyndon Johnson and John Kennedy both had these machines in their Oval Office at the White House recording their phone conversations so they could be reviewed or stored for historical purposes. So there are tens of thousands of these belts, for example, in presidential library collections. Also, there's one particular belt which is quite famous and controversial, which was recorded by the Dallas, Texas Police Department, and they were using a machine like this to monitor radio traffic at all times, but particularly when President Kennedy was assassinated in 1963, the machine was monitoring the police radio traffic. And so there's been a controversy about that particular recording over the years as to whether you can hear gunshots on it or not. So what I'm going to do is, just to give you an idea of the material that you'll see on these and the quality of the sound, I'm going to play you an excerpt from actually one of the belts that the Dallas Police Department recorded. This is a little while after the actual assassination occurred, and you can hear the sort of all points bulletin that's going out. Could you make that out, right? It's a description of a man and a weapon, which presumably was Lee Harvey Oswald. So the final one I'll play is, this is a recording that was made at the White House about seven or eight months later, and it's Johnson is now the president, and he's talking to a man named McGeorge Bundy, who was his national security advisor at the time, and they're talking about the Vietnam situation. The U.S. has not really gotten engaged yet, and they're sort of talking about, well, what might happen.
I don't hear you, the more I just sit awake last night thinking about this thing, the more I think of it, I don't know what in the hell it looks like we were getting into another Korean. It just worries the hell out of me. I don't see what we can ever hope to get out of there with once we're committed. Once I believe the Chinese communists coming into it, I don't think that we can try to 10,000 miles away from home and ever get anywhere in that area. I don't think it's worth fighting for, and I don't think we can get out. And it's just a big damn mess.
It is an awful mess.
And we just got to think about that. If I look at this sergeant of mine this morning, got six little kids over there, and he's things and bringing me in my night reading and all that kind of stuff. And I just thought about all the kids in there, and what in the hell am I ordering out there for? One thing that they'll say it made them worth to me. What is Laos worth to me? What is it worth to this country?
Okay, so what I tried to show you with this slide is that certainly there's a huge range of material from music through historical representations of events of all sorts of types, and I think that's a good argument for the value of these kind of collections. Okay, so there is a whole field of audio restoration that has been developed over the years, and it's actually very successful, and you can do incredible things reducing noise and improving the quality of the sound in old recordings. And the techniques that the experts use sort of fall into two categories. One is sort of materials. It's almost a craft, but how you clean and prepare the surfaces, choices you make about the geometry of the needle for particular samples, methods to repair things that are damaged or broken. Once you play a recording by placing a needle on it and spinning it, you now have a signal, a waveform, and you can process that waveform either in analog form or in digital form. And there are many software products and hardware tools now that can be used to sense the presence of these clicks and pops and do noise subtractions of the broadband noise and so forth. And you can really improve the sound quite a bit. But to do any of these things, you obviously have to make contact to the record, and you have to have the skilled people on hand. So our sort of stepping off point into this thing was the perception that people wanted to get away from the needing to put a needle down on it and see if we could sort of lift off from there. So the idea, as I was just saying, was to have a non-contact method of playing a recording. And if you could do that, first of all, obviously you could protect the sample from any further damage. Once it's in a digital form, the form of an image, instead of a waveform, but actually an image of the surface, you could think of improving the sound or restoring it through a kind of Photoshop touch-up sort of idea. You could actually remove the scratches, remove the dirt particles if they're not too large, in the image before you actually emulate the motion of the stylus through it. And of course, if you could do this in a good, efficient way, you could potentially make kind of expert software that would offload a lot of the special techniques that the audio engineers need to automated software. And it becomes almost like a smart copying machine. So the approach then would be, obviously, to image the surface, cover the surface with many images like you might do if you were doing aerial map making, stitch them all together so you get a consistent and well-aligned map of the entire surface, and then process that image of the surface through image processing methods to remove defects, and analyze then the topography of this model to calculate how the stylus would move through it, and then sample that stylus motion to make it digital and convert it to a digital sound format, and then basically you have your playback. And when we thought we would do this, we thought we're not going to try to make a real-time player that you would stick the disc into any time you wanted to play it, but rather it would be a transfer process that would move it from the physical artifact into the digital realm, say, once. So how do you do these various steps? Well, there are a couple of different ways that you can image a surface. You can use an electronic camera, which essentially takes a three-dimensional object and maps it into two dimensions. So this is a microphotograph of a very small region, a millimeter or so, less half a millimeter or so, of the surface of a 780 RPM disk. And we've illuminated it with light which is perpendicular to the surface, so it's coaxial with the optics. Things that are flat, such as the surface of the record or the bottom of the groove, reflect the light back up into the sensor. But things that are not flat, such as the sloping sides of the groove, they come back as black. If you want to extract sound from this, and remember we talked about the scales of microns that characterize the groove movement, you basically need, as a rough rule of thumb, about one pixel in your imager should map to about one micron on the surface of the disk. And here I've blown up one of these regions here, and you actually very well resolve a little chunk of dirt or something which is sitting inside the groove. So this is an okay way, at least in principle, to try and lift the information about the groove trajectory from a disk, okay? Because a disk, the movement of the groove is just from side to side. But if you remember when I talked about cylinders, I told you that the valley floor is moving up and down. So now I need a way to measure the third dimension. And a two-dimensional camera is just not a very good way to measure distance. You can get some information using stereo or something, but it's not a very precise way to do it. But there are many measurement techniques which are non-contact and can be used to measure surface profiles as well. And we looked at various ones, and the one that we sort of settled on as the most appropriate is based upon the effect of chromatic aberration. That's usually a bad thing. It causes like blooming in photographs, and it's due to the fact that different colors of light can be dispersed by a lens and come into focus at different positions. As with most bad things, you can often apply them as an advantage in other contexts. And so there's a device which is a variation on what's called the confocal scanning probe, which you can purchase commercially, which takes advantage of chromatic aberration to allow you to measure variations in the height of a surface to a fraction of a micron. The way it works is that there's a white light source, which is defined by a pinhole, and brought into focus, this is a lens, through a lens with a large chromatic aberration. The different colors of light come into focus at different depths. They then reflect off the surface through a beam splitter into another pinhole and into a spectrometer. And by sensing which colors come back in focus, you can correlate that with the height of the surface. And this image that I've shown you now a couple of times was actually taken with just such an instrument. It measures a very small region of the surface, a few microns in diameter at a time. And so it repeatedly has to be placed point by point over the surface in a scanning fashion. It doesn't capture just a view at once. It's a scanning tool. But it has the requisite accuracy and resolution to get the kind of information that you need from a surface like this to reconstruct the sound. Now, how fast do these measurements go, and how much data does that actually get generated when you do this? So if you use the right kind of cameras, if you really think about what's the best way to take a two-dimensional image of a surface, you can pretty much collect the data that you need in 10 minutes or something from a 78 RPM kind of scale, 10-inch diameter disk. Of course, you're taking images, and images can be quite large. So if you say, well, there's about 3 minutes of sound on a disk, and how much data does it take to cover it? It's about 50 megabytes of raw images with, if you do no compression at all, per second of sound. Once you start to process those images and extract information from them, it drops by big factors. And finally, if you actually just pull the sound out, the minimum is going to be just the typical sound file size, which is on your CDs, for example, of 88 kilobytes per second. Instead, if you want to use the full three-dimensional scanning method, it's a very slow process because you're taking points at a rate that's limited by the firing rate of this device, which is fundamentally limited by the amount of light you can get down and reflect back off. So really, if you want to do this, it takes a day or days to cover the surface area of a cylinder that might only have 3 minutes of sound on it. Now, that seems like a lot. However, I gave you the sort of preservation idea and access idea, and you can sort of see that this might be a preservation tool, whereas this might be more of an access-oriented approach. Now, Now I've got these images by one, you know, by one way or another, I got them. And now I can process them because they're in digital form, and I can extract information about the structures that I've imaged. So an image is just, you know, a table of intensities at, you know, for each pixel, and then I can look at how the intensity is changing and so forth, and I can assign certain criteria to an algorithm which will basically let me define where the edges are in an image. And now I'm getting very close to the kind of mechanical information I need to actually take the sound out. Another thing I can do is I can apply morphology to the image. I can change it by defining functions of a neighborhood or something like that. And these kind of transformations can be used essentially as automatic touch-up features to remove gaps and so forth. You can never put information in that's been lost, but you can remove the offending effect of a defect. Another thing which is important to remember in both images like this, which relate to the 2D materials, and also to the full three-dimensional images, is that the groove on any kind of a recording is very well defined geometrically because it's formed by a tool that originally cut it. And all that happens is the groove moves. And so you can assign the shape of the groove as a criteria when you go and look at the image for flagging the bad regions. So the groove geometry is a really important constraint that you can use when you're trying to figure out if what you're imaging is good stuff or bad stuff. Another thing you have to think about, and now we're actually getting very close to the sound, is what is the relationship between the movement of this groove and the sound that we're eventually going to hear? So remember, we had an acoustic era and an electrical era. So let's talk about the electrical era first. The cartridge and stylus, which many people are familiar with, basically is electromagnetic in its function. So when the stylus rides through, it moves, and it causes a magnet to move near a coil. So we've got induction. And you know right away that what matters is not the position of the needle, it's its velocity. So really what the sound is when we play a record, at least electromagnetically, is we're listening to the speed of the stylus. We're listening to the slope of the groove at any point, not its actual shape. And so what this indicates is that the sound is going to be loudest when the groove is actually doing its zero crossings rather than at its maximum displacement. So another way of saying that is sound equals stylus velocity. And people in the audio world, this is what they call the constant velocity condition, which is a term that you would hear if you started reading sort of audio books. Now, what about the acoustic case? Well, there's no electromagnetic induction. There's a dog, and there's a horn, and there's a diaphragm, and a stylus. So this is a mechanical system. So does the sound follow the displacement of the stylus now, or does it follow its velocity? You have to ask the question fresh. Well, what the horn does is it extends the frequency response of the diaphragm to lower frequencies. Now the diaphragm starts to move, and it's a driven harmonic oscillator. It's like a drum head. And what you want that oscillator to do is to have as flat a frequency response as possible. Otherwise, it would work really well at certain notes, but not at others. So it's going to be heavily overdamped. And in the extreme of overdamping, it's the nature of a harmonic oscillator that its velocity is the thing that follows the driving force. So once again, it's exactly the same thing. It's the velocity, but for completely different reasons. This all breaks down at some higher frequency when you get into the mass-dominated behavior of the oscillator. And it turns out for these geometries, masses, and materials, that happens at around 5 kilohertz. So acoustic recordings before the electrical era basically are dead above 5,000 hertz. Okay. Now, I'm going to talk to you about actually trying to do this and seeing how well it works in practice. But I'll make a little comparison beforehand. Obviously, this is data intensive. The speed that it takes to do this is a concern, particularly in that 3D full profilimetry approach. Now I have to try to prove to you that you can actually get sufficient fidelity if you do this. And of course, there are all these restoration methods that are already available. On the other hand, if I do this, I don't have to touch the record. I don't particularly care what it's made of, whether it's wax, metal, shellac, glass, silly putty, or anything, because as long as I can get images from it, it's somehow doable. The effects of damage and debris can be reduced by image processing rather than filtering a waveform. A broken disc could be reassembled and put back together in this way. The noise sources, which are resolved in what we call a spatial domain, actually as the lumps and bumps of garbage, which is what caused them, rather than as sort of a random occurrence in a waveform. So you're sort of turning a sort of random process into a pattern recognition kind of problem. The groove geometry is an important constraint that you can use to actually do this. Skips or scratch, you know, jumping of the needle, of course, won't occur anymore. And the low frequency distortions, which are due to rumble, motor, off-center rotation, those can be either absent or resolved as kind of geometrical corrections to the data. And, of course, when we think about the mass digitization, the intervention of an operator during the whole process could be reduced. And potentially, someone with less training could do this, which could be an advantage if you're trying to do a large number of transcriptions. So, as I said, this idea sort of came to us kind of by accident, and we were using a bunch of tools that looked very much like some of the things I described already in the lab to build our detectors and so forth. So we said, okay, well, let's try to do this. So here's my colleague, Vitaly Fadeyev, and this is a machine which is called an optical scanning system, and it has the 2D camera and the appropriate optics, and the computer can tell it to move around, and we placed the disc on it, and we programmed it, it's programmable, to essentially walk around and measure the trajectory of the groove at many, 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 many points as it worked its way around. This machine was not meant to do this job. I mean, the engineers who built it, and in fact, it's made in Rochester just across the pond, and this was not their conception of what this was going to be for. So in fact, it wasn't optimized to do this at all. And it took 40 minutes, essentially, to go around and get 1 second of sound. And so we had this thing running sort of at night over many, many, whatever, days or to do various tests, you know, in our spare time to see if this was actually workable. So I'll show you this little clip of actually what happens. It's not a very well edited clip, but it kind of gives you a sense of what actually happened. I don't know why we don't see it. Oh, there it is. I'm sorry. Okay, so I'll give you a little narration. Here's obviously a disc, and it just kind of, this is the establishing shot. And now it's sitting on the table of this machine, and there's the terminal, and you can see the image of the groove. If there's some way to lower the lights, this might actually look better. I don't know if you can do that. What it's doing right now is it's taking a measurement of the hole in the center of the record, because that's going to be like a coordinate, an axis origin. Okay. And it can recognize that edge and sort of fit points to it and calculate where the center is. That's a feature of the machine. Okay. Now, it's going to move over and it's going to go now to the area where the groove actually is. It's going to autofocus on it. And now you see those little crosses? That's its measurement of the edge of the groove. And it's going to do it twice at each position. And so measuring, it's looking at the bottom of the groove, that white stripe, and it's measuring it twice and then moving on to another view. And it's interesting because the fact that we were able to get the machine to do this, when I told this to the engineers at the company actually just the other day, they told me that we were exploiting a bug in their system that they've since removed. So anyway, but it did work. So here's that data. Okay, now that was time going up the page. I've rotated it around, and this is time in the other direction. And these are those points on either side of the groove that you just saw measuring. So it's a series of images, and they're overlapping. Those are the little overlaps. Now, an interesting thing you can do, and this comes like, if you're a high-energy physicist and you've ever worked on tracking analysis, this will sound very familiar to you, because we're going to take advantage of a constraint in our detector or in our data. The distance, you can make a histogram of the distance between the points on either side of the groove. And that histogram clusters around a value, in this case of 7 microns, which is the width of that white stripe. So if there's a piece of dust or debris, you're typically not going to measure 7 microns. You're going to measure something which is rather different. So you can, and here's that histogram, and there's those tails. And you can actually cut those measurements out of the data set. And those correspond to removing some of the effects of debris or damage in the data. So We take advantage of the redundancy of both the overlapped images and the fact that we're doing two measurements and average this data to get this. And then through a process of numerical differentiation, point by point, we can measure the slope. So now we're getting at the Stiles velocity. And this is very much almost sound. Okay, now it's just a matter of resampling it to the appropriate frequency and putting it into the form of some digital sound format. So here's the result of doing this for about 20 seconds of sound. This is the envelope of the sound as read optically, and this is the envelope of the sound as read by that same disc playing it with a needle. If I look at some 40 millisecond region, it's, again, very, very similar, but now on the microscale, except some of the sharper features are gone. Now, that particular disc, if you read it, is Goodnight Irene, which is a song that many people know and some people don't, but was quite popular, a hit, I'm told, in 1950. A lot of children like this song because they think it sounds like a lullaby. If you actually listen to the words, it's about murder, adultery, suicide, and drugs. So young people, I'm going to play it, but the younger people should probably go out of the room. Okay. This man, Huddy Ledbetter, wrote the song. And this is actually John Lomax, who actually found him, so to speak, in a prison in Louisiana and recorded this song in his version. But this is now a commercial version of it. So it was recently re-released by this group. It was remastered and re-released on CD from the original studio tape. So here's a kind of reference version. Okay, so now here's playing it with the needle. Now here's this whole optical data gathering and analysis chain. So you can hear, obviously, that the crackles and clicks and pops are now reduced. But there's also a hiss that's quite present, and it's modulated. Turns out that that's due to a resolution effect, which is a function of position on that measuring system. And I'm going to show you some data in a couple of minutes where that's now been removed because we've optimized and actually built something which is particularly suited to do this job rather than adapting an existing machine. But this was the first thing that we did a couple years ago, and we wrote a paper about this and sent it around to various libraries and archives to see whether, you know, is this interesting, is this anything worthwhile, or so forth. And we got a very strong response from the Library of Congress in the U.S. because they have this major sound collection and they're interested in migrating it to digital form. And this whole idea of a semi-automated kind of non-contact process was very attractive to them. And so we had a meeting about this, and they said, look, this is promising, but 40 minutes per second is ridiculous. Is there some way that you can actually make this run fast? And I indicated to you that with the right tools, that should be possible. So we ended up basically writing a proposal to take this to the next step. But it's going to cost money, and it's going to require engineering and so forth. But this proposal was submitted to our National Endowment for the Humanities, which is a funding agency that funds research in or related to the humanities and humanities collections. And we called it Irene, and I'll give you the reason why later, but they essentially funded it, and now we actually have this project and we're trying to build this machine. And I'll show you how a prototype of it works. They also wanted us to pursue the full three-dimensional method. They understood that it was slow, but they thought perhaps it will get faster in the future and it might be very powerful as a preservation tool. So in the remaining time, I'm going to just tell you where we're going with Irene and give you a demonstration of its early performance, and then tell you a little bit about what we've done in the three-dimensional side. So Irene, it means image, reconstruct, erase, noise, etc. So, okay. So, you know, your program officer, your granting officer, can't tell you that you can't upgrade if you include et cetera, you know, in your acronym. So anyway, it's a workstation of sorts that will scan in an appropriate way in two dimensions only the disk. And it's essentially under development and construction now. And it's going to be a test bed. Once it's built, it's going to go to Washington. And people in the Recorded Sound Division and the Preservation Division at the library will use it and test it on a statistically significant sample of recordings and, you know, try to see how it really works, you know, on the floor. As I said, 2D, we're going to try to make it run as fast as possible, encompass a variety of media, reconstruct broken disks if you provide the parts, use off-the-shelf components, be as friendly as possible. And the trick to making this run fast is to not use an area scan camera, but to use a line scan instead. A line scan camera means you arrange the pixels in one long line. This is, you know, great for barcode reading and fax machines and so forth. But if you orient this properly over the surface of a disk and you start taking pictures and you rotate the disk underneath the camera, it just takes the record and it unrolls it into a long stripe. And here's one such stripe coming from one revolution of the disk of about a dozen grooves. And of course, you've got to use the right optics, and you buy that in Rochester as well, because, you know, that's where you get the good stuff. And here's a kind of blow up of a little region of this thing, and you can see computer algorithm actually doing the edge finding on the groove. And this can run, and depending on how you orient it, you can sample the disk at an effective sampling time of almost 400 kilohertz, which is 10 times higher than our typical CD sampling, and I think much more than you actually need, but that's kind of the physical limit of that performance. Here's a picture of the prototype of this thing, and maybe you want to shut the light again, because I'm going to show you a couple of film clips too, but you've got your disk on a turntable on a stage that can move from side to side and rotate under the control of a motion control system. Here's the line scan camera, frame grabber, cables, the optics, then the light guide that's supplying the light through a port so you get that coaxial illumination that you need. And this is a laser which measures the distance. It's a laser displacement that measures the distance to the surface of the disk, because the disk is warped and you've got to keep it in focus at all times. If you want high resolution, narrow depth of field, so you've got to maintain the control over focus. So here's a little movie showing the thing scanning and collecting data. So there's a little spot. That's where the data is being taken. This is a 1937 recording transcription disc of an interview with Howard Hughes. And there's the line scan data. You can see it's moving as the lines get put up on the screen. Okay, that's just a display. So the next one is just to show you how that focus control works. And so here's the bottom of the lens, and you're going to see I'm going to take this broken record and stick it under there so the record's going to get twice as thick. And this is the laser sensor, and it's going to command this thing through a control loop to move up out of the way. Right, and you see that. And then you'll see the motor that does it, that pushes it up and down. So it's just sitting there constantly monitoring the surface. Okay, so we tested it, and we did a very cursory analysis, just does this work? Now, this thing ran at 13 seconds per second of audio, as opposed to 40 minutes per second. So it's like a 400 times increase. And with brighter light sources, it's going to run at just a few seconds per second. So that was a kind of a big jump. I mean, would this work at all? That we weren't sure. I mean, the record's now going to be in motion all the time, et cetera, et cetera. Here's the stylus playback, and here's the scan of it using the scanning machine. And the clip I chose was a little bit regionally motivated. I would prefer if I also had O Canada to do. I would demonstrate that to you, but instead I have God Bless America. And this is the version of Kate Smith singing it, I guess late 1930s, sort of playing it with a needle. Okay. That's all you get. So, and here's playing it with this scanner and a very kind of first pass attempt at analyzing the data. Okay, so this told us that we were sort of going in the right direction, that this, you know, you could make this big jump and you could make something that was reasonably efficient and you know, was already, with a simple analysis, giving you some reasonable results. We tried a couple of other tests. This is a very old sort of 1920s disk that was really dirty and in bad condition. So I didn't try to clean it or anything. I just put it down. Here's what it sounds like if you play it. Okay, and then here's the scan with the optical scanner. Yeah, so you can see it actually pulled off some of the superficial effect of essentially the grime on it. This is another one which had a bunch of distortion in it when we played it with a stylus. It's a Russian folk song, typically late 1920s. Okay, and then the scan. Okay. So anyway, I think we feel that we're sort of going in a good direction with this. And right now, it's actually being refined, and we're moving from the prototype more to a second configuration and developing really the software that's going to be used. So the last thing is the cylinder stuff. In the last couple of minutes, I'll tell you about that. And here we arranged the confocal scanning probe, which I talked about before, on a scanning system, and it scans along the axis of the cylinder, and the cylinder rotates, it scans again, and images like this, these are the points it's measuring sort of a dozen points across the groove, so that's kind of sufficient information for me to actually then fit these shapes and determine cut by cut what the depth is. And here's the data. It's a series of these things that I then can arrange into the full surface, and here's it all kind of assembled in a kind of condensed view. This is the distance of the probe from the surface. This is angle around the cylinder, and this is distance along the cylinder axis. If it was a perfectly sharp, clear, perfect cylinder, it would be flat in this view. Instead, here the ruffles have ridges. Those are the grooves, and then all these long lobes are the deformations of the surface, which are on the scale of a few hundred microns. But by taking the data in this form, you get a global view of the entire surface. And these lumps and bumps are things that will give you low-frequency artifacts when you play it back. But since you know the entire surface geometry, you can actually go and fit for those things and try to remove them as overall corrections. And I mentioned that before. Once you've analyzed these, you fit for the groove depth at every point, and you construct the waveform. You then have to differentiate it to get it into the form of stylus velocity. And the way we differentiate it is it's discrete data. So we transform this time series into the frequency domain. And in the frequency domain, each term just gets multiplied by I omega. So the effect of doing a derivative is to just boost the high frequencies in proportion to their frequency. And you can also very conveniently apply the filtering at sort of 5K in the same operation. So that's a nice way to differentiate this data. So here's the canonical comparison, stylus versus needle. Sorry, stylus versus profile scan on the micro scale and the macro scale. And we're kind of running out of time, so I'm just going to play you one of two that I have. They're also on our website, which I'll point to you in a moment. So here it is playing it with a needle. Okay, now here's the optical analysis. This was played on an electrical player a modern version of the Edison cylinder player, which exists now for use in these libraries. So here's the optical version of that cylinder. Now, here's something which is interesting and sort of fun, particularly for a physicist. Here's a group of people at a recording session, which would have been around that same time. And they're all clustered around this horn, and they're singing and playing into the horn. Now, this horn is shaped like a cone. Now, they didn't know really the physics of the horn until about 1918, when Webster wrote the horn equations down, and then there was a lot of development with Morse and other people in understanding horns. If they had known about the horn, they would have known that the horn which flares, the exponential horn, has a much better low-frequency behavior than the horn which is conical. But they used conical horns quite extensively in recording. So they were sort of undermining the low-frequency and kind of giving that tinny sound that we're familiar with from these older recordings. And they could have done better. So we obviously are free, if we want, to try to put some reversal to the extent that some of the low frequencies are there but are attenuated. And so I added a little additional filtering and boosted the low frequencies according to sort of those curves, using those curves as a guide. So I think, that's nice. It's not something you have to do, but I think from some points of view, it adds something to the experience. So the 3D stuff is also a parallel research line. We're studying the data quality versus the speed of the probe, the grid spacing, the number of points to take to try to optimize how long this process takes. We're also trying to study some of the media with mold to see if we can extract information that would otherwise seem to be lost. And we're also looking at 3D on disks and other materials. So I had some stuff about mold, but I think we'll skip that today because of the hour. But let me just say, obviously, it's been an interesting project to work on. And we've tried. Media seems to be interested in this. So, you get to be interviewed sometimes and in the newspaper or whatever. And, really try to emphasize that, this is the way a physicist would approach this problem. And the media seems to be pretty receptive to that kind of angle. And I think our community in general, not just particle physicists, can always outreach better and try to contact, the general community and show that we can, aid them in various ways. Now, Physics Today wrote an article about this project, and they called it Particle Tracking Tunes Up Music. And then after that article was published, I found an article that a music professor wrote describing our project and addressing his community. And this was the title of his article. So I thought that was great. I was really happy. Okay. So in conclusion, I would like to say that I hope I've convinced you that this kind of an image-based approach, dealing with the surface in digital form and then trying to actually do everything once I've gotten a surface on the computer, has sufficient resolution and looks like a promising direction. It's going to be addressed in a much more complete and less anecdotal way on a larger sample through this project that we're doing for the Library of Congress. And the 3D methods, of course, look to be very powerful. I think the results were better with the 3D probe than so far we've seen with the 2D scanning. But, of course, they're not very efficient, and that's something that's going to be looked at. And eventually, maybe a three-dimensional scanning system that could be user-friendly might be in the offing. There's obviously been a lot of professional and public interest in this, and it's a good vehicle to communicate the impact of physics and physics methods on other fields. This is our website where a talk like this is posted with embedded sound clips if you want to look at it at your leisure. Two papers so far were accepted and published by the Audio Engineering Society, and there's a couple more that will come out of this probably in the next year or so. So thank you for your interest and your attention, and I'll be happy to answer any questions. So when you say that you were impressed with the quality of the cylinder playback, do you mean when I played it with a needle or when we reconstructed?
No, well, certainly the optical.
Okay, I would attribute the optical, your impression of the optical playback mostly to the actual data that we took, because we measured that surface at extremely high resolution and we sampled it in the time direction at very, very high sampling rates. So we were free to really exploit a much larger amount of information than the needle would. And you know, when you multiply your information by a factor of 10 or 30, the amount of signal averaging and redundancy that you're going to be able to achieve is just greater. And I mean, I don't think that the inherent quality of the sort of 1910 cylinder recordings were better than the electrical recordings. I mean, the frequency response of electrical recordings of sort of circa 1930 and onwards, I mean, that went up into the over 10,000 to 15,000 hertz. Whereas cylinder recordings, because of the acoustical nature of the process, I mean, those just are out at 5 kilohertz. And we can certainly hear above 5. Well, I certainly think that if the oscillator is cutting off at 5 kilohertz, there's not much we're going to be able to do about that, because the recording mechanism was not sensitive. But what would we do? So let's say that a particular artist had recorded something in the acoustic era and then re-recorded it later. But what would we, it's not clear to me what we would be able to do with the newer information to actually apply it to the, I mean, we'd know what he said, but I mean, there might be some forensic, particularly like forensic angle that we could use if, for example, I mean, maybe an example might be if we could get some information off, and it wasn't a question of being outside the frequency range, but there was some distortion within the range, and we had some information about this person's voice from another source. Maybe we could do something in terms of being able to find out what he was saying or something like that. But that's nothing particular about what we're doing. I mean, there's a whole field of audio forensics that the, you know, police use, and the FBI and the CIA and whatever. And I mean, they're interested in pulling sounds out of very noisy or distorted waveforms. But that's a signal processing issue. And my knowledge of that is, I have some, but I'm certainly not an expert in that area. But maybe. I mean, there's a book you might want to look at, which is called Modern Audio Restoration by, slipping my mind, but these two guys in England, they work at Cambridge, but they have a company which is called Cedar, which is sort of a world leader in this whole signal processing for audio area. And if you look under Cedar, CEDAR, and you Google it, you'll get to their website for sure.
Jason, are you using iBeam to look at stereo?
Okay, so for the way stereo works is that the groove, so in a monaural recording, the groove just moves from side to side. For stereo, it's called the 45-45 system. So the two channels are encoded in a vertical movement of the two groove walls. And so that's already implicitly a 3D issue. So you would need to use a 3D scanner to measure the full surface like we did on a cylinder in order to get stereo out. So that's not going to be a fast process. And so we are trying some tests of trying to just measure the full groove profile with the confocal probe. The problem is that the groove on a disc is at 45 degrees, whereas the groove on a cylinder, it's more of a kind of parabolic, but it's got a kind of 10 to 1 aspect ratio, so the angles are much smaller, and it's harder to measure steep angles with the probe, so we're looking at tilting the probes and things. So we're looking at it, but we don't see a way to do it really efficiently. The other thing to say is that stereophonic recordings are all post-1958. In those days, the group would go into the studio or wherever the recording was done. It would be mastered to tape. Most of those tape masters still exist in the vaults of the record companies. So from the preservation and restoration point of view, it's really the older materials where there were no tape masters that are of more interest. And so we've all put that whole modern era kind of at a much, much lower interest sort of priority than addressing the kind of pre-1950 aspect of the collection. Oh, sorry. Well, the other surface profiling method that... So we looked at a whole range of surface height measurement because, for example, in high-energy physics, when we're building the silicon arrays that William was talking about, another thing we're very interested in is looking at how, on the micron scale, our detectors deform as the temperature varies. So we're quite familiar with sort of... TV holography methods and other kind of ways of measuring surfaces. And so the way that looked most promising other than the confocal scanning was white light interferometry. And that's a whole other discussion. We've done studies with white light interferometry. We've measured regions of these recordings. And also, we got the company that has white light systems, they manufacture them, to scan a few revolutions for us. The problem with the white light interferometry is that it doesn't work as well on any angles. Slopes than the confocal method does. And so a lot more data is lost in the process of measuring it. So I got a little bit seduced by it, but then I felt that it wasn't as good as it sort of looked to be. So I if I had more time, I would have included it in the presentation, but I don't really have sound results from it. So I think the confocal method right now, in my opinion, is it's the best one. And we have looked at others. Well, I mean, the question of what do you save, obviously, the way I presented the data, it's a reductive process, right? And so the question of, well, what do you save when you do this certainly has come up. And the automatic reaction in the library is save everything. So, but of course, you could always retake the image maybe in the future with even better quality systems. So there's a little bit of arbitrariness to it as well. I expect that, you know, in the early testing of this thing, they'll buy a whole bunch of drives and save all the images, and then at some point the practical aspect of it will kick in. But I mean, let me just give you one last example about that. I was telling you about that dictation belt from Dallas, right, which is a one-of-a-kind, very special thing. So that's in the possession of our National Archives. That's the agency in Washington that holds the records of anything to do with the government. And they have that belt, and it's broken and cracked, and it's worn from multiple plays by the FBI, whoever, you know, back in the 60s and 70s. So they have it. And they would like to stabilize it and somehow make it, preserve it, and also make it available for forensics people in the future who might want to analyze it and stuff. So they actually asked us to consider the possibility of scanning this belt. And the strategy would be to scan it with the absolute highest number of measurements that we could practically do. and more than we could even conceivably want to extract the sound from it. And that would create this huge data map of this thing, which would reside on a computer. And that would become sort of the copy that people could have if they want to. And they weren't even interested in us analyzing the stylus motion through it, because that's not their issue. That's not their job. They're not supposed to play the things. They're just supposed to store them, right? And they also don't want to, obviously, there's a reluctance to get into the whole forensics side of this thing. So that would be an example that you gave of, just like you gave, let's create an image and store that. And in fact, these belts, they harden over time, and they do decay. So they're anxious to do this, and they actually have funded us to work on just such a process.